Michael Moss was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for explanatory reporting in 2010. He was also a finalist for the prize in 2006 and 1999. Before coming to the New York Times, he was a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, Newsday, and the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Michael's book, Sugar, Salt, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us, has been a phenomenal bestseller, and it's now available in paperback. Welcome, Michael, and thanks for joining us on the Book Report.
Great to talk to you.
Your book has so many facts that just make your hair stand on edge. For example, a cup of Yoplait has as much sugar as a bowl of Lucky Charms.
You have to realize that one of the things that concerns nutritionists is not just that the food companies have engineers on staff, food chemists, who perfect the perfect amounts of sugar, which they call the bliss point, in things like ice cream and soda, but they've marched around the grocery store adding sugar to products that didn't used to be sweet before, so that now bread has added sugar and a bliss point that'll send us over the moon. Yogurt, as you mentioned, can have as much sugar in it as ice cream. Pasta sauces can have the equivalent of a couple of Oreo cookies worth of sugar in a tiny half-cup serving. And what this does is teaches us to expect sweetness in everything we eat. Kids are especially hardwired for the sweet taste. So when you drag their little bodies over to the produce aisle and try to get them to eat more Brussels sprouts and broccoli, which every nutritionist says we should be doing, they're going to get those bitter notes. Forget about it.
Right. You say in the book that Americans consume 71 pounds of caloric sweeteners each year, or 22 teaspoons of sugar per person per day. So if you're switching to sugar-free soda, for example, does that have any kind of an impact?
Maybe, maybe not. I mean, there's some sense that diet sodas especially haven't been the silver bullet for dieting that people were hoping there were, because if you tinker with just one of these three things, salt, sugar, and fat, you're going to, you know, you're not dealing with the whole picture. And there's also some sense, too, that people will have a diet soda and then think it's a prophylactic against calories, and they'll have an extra cookie or a muffin, and that, frankly, will wipe out what other gain you're doing from that. So, you know, dieting is complicated.
What about low-fat products?
You know, I'm starting to come around to the notion that the whole low-fat focus has also played right into the hands of the processed food industry, that it may actually be smarter to go with a whole fat yogurt, for example, if you can limit the amount that you're doing. Yes, you're getting more saturated fat, but you're also getting more satisfaction or satiety. It's going to fill you up more. And the dangerous low fat is that you replace the fat with sugar. And the smartest nutritionists and experts out there are now saying that that's a really bad trade-off. You're much better off getting the fat.
Hmm. You know, the book alludes to the fact that there's a close connection between the food giants and big tobacco. Can you talk a little about that?
In a really surprising way, and this is one of the reasons why the research and reporting for this book for me was like being inside a detective story, the largest tobacco company of all, Philip Morris, became the largest food company in North America when it bought the old General Foods Company and then Kraft in the 80s. And for the 80s and the 90s, and I was privy to the internal documents, you can see the tobacco managers doing what you would expect them to do. They're nudging and cajoling and sometimes lending some of their own marketing schemes to their food company, to the food executives, to get them to sell more product. But starting in the late 90s, Philip Morris breaks with the tobacco industry, becomes the first company to embrace government regulation. And when it does, of tobacco, and when it does that, the tobacco managers turn privately to their food executives and warn them that they are going to have as much trouble, if not more, on salt, sugar, fat, obesity as the tobacco executives were already having with nicotine, cigarettes, and that they're going to have to do something to lessen their dependence on what I call the holy trinity of the processed food industry, salt, sugar, fat.
Mm. Do you believe our government is doing any watchdogging of the food industry?
Really taken aback by how the government regulators who are supposed to be there watching over the companies for us are in many ways less powerful than the companies themselves, and quite often they're working together. I tell the story about cheese and how the USDA came up with a marketing plan that helped the dairy industry turn cheese into not something you eat for itself or in a sandwich, but into an additive. So now you go to the dairy aisle and it's filled with bags that are stuffed with cheese that's shredded, diced, cubed, tubbed, much of it processed cheese, all to get us to use more cheese as an additive to ingredients. Bottom line, our consumption of cheese has tripled since the 70s to an average of 33 pounds per person per year.
Ugh. Michael, I think your book should be required reading for med students. Do you think that medical schools are doing enough to spread the word about better nutrition?
You know, it's really, medical schools, yes, to some extent. I mean, nutritionists know, and they all say that, look, we should be eating twice as many vegetables and whole fruits that we are now for better health. The real key, I think, has to start younger in grammar school. I write about the demise of the home economic system in this country, where girls and to some extent boys were taught how to shop, how to cook, how to be mindful of food. I don't think we can go back to that. But I'm noticing that even kids are reading the book because they're really jazzed by food in the context of politics and the sort of situation of these multinational corporations shaping our eating habits. And that is really attractive to kids. And I think that you can talk to them and engage them in a conversation about food through the politics of food.
Now, you highlight some examples of companies trying to make their food healthier. Are there any changes you see as truly positive?
Yeah, I think you're starting to see some edging. And again, you know, since the book came out a year ago in hardcover, and it just came out in paper now, the companies have been under increasing pressure to improve the health profile of their products. They're really good at cutting back on one of the three, salt, sugar, or fat, and often what they do is increase the other two. But now they're looking at sort of total calories, and it's a real open question still whether they can really do it. Their food scientists are convinced that if they try hard enough, they can. But after a while, if you really whack back at the salt and the sugar and the fat all together in many of these products, you have to ask, really, what's left?
Mm. Okay, I'm so interested to know what you're setting your sights on for your next investigation.
You know, I'm actually going to do another book for Random House that looks more deeply at this question of food and free will and addiction. I've used the A word very sparingly, and I'm going into the world of science to see just what we know about that and how relevant the A word can be for treatment programs and sort of what some of the alternatives that have been, you know, fobbed upon us as silver bullets in response to food and especially these hyper-engineered products.
Michael, what can shoppers do when they walk into a grocery store? You allude to some shopping lists.
So the first thing to realize is that when you walk in the door, the supermarket, the retailer, and the manufacturers are doing everything they can to get you to make an impulsive, spontaneous decision. That's why supermarkets are like this la-la land of soft music and bright neon colors and strategic positioning where the food manufacturers pay extra to position those products in the most visible parts of the store. So first thing to combat that and to sort of get in and out with your good health, make a list, do your best to stick with it because they're trying to get you off of that shopping list. Work the outer perimeter of the store. That's where the produce is and the less processed meats and dairy. Be careful throughout the inner part of the store in the middle parts of the aisle at eye level, because the companies do experiments where they've put devices on people's heads that measure their eye movements, and they know that when we step into the aisle, our attention goes to the eye level middle part of the aisle. That's where the most sugary products are, for example, in the cereal aisle. So if you're looking for a plain Cheerios or plain oatmeal, you're typically going to have to look low on the ground or reach way up high. And lastly, the checkout counter, be really careful that you're standing in line. They're starting to put coolers of soda there to just tempt you to reach in and take that as well.
I personally read the trash magazines while I'm waiting.
Hey, that's totally safe.
Okay.
Right? No calories in that.
What about, the, quote, organic or natural food aisle?
I think that, and again, nutritionists are telling me, scientists, look, if you can afford it, chances are with organic, you're going to get somewhat lower profiles of pesticides. That's what they're about. But you have to remember that just the word organic on a product can mean that it's just as loaded with calories, with fat, with salt and sugar as a non-organic product. So it's become sort of part of this front of the label health washing touting that goes on to basically put us at ease and keep us from looking at the fine print on the back of the package.
So read the labels once and always.
Right.
Well, Michael, I think your book is required reading for anyone who spends a dime in a grocery store. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. For a preview of Salt, Sugar, Fat, check bookreportradio.com, archived shows, week of February 16th, 2013.